You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a barbershop owner trying to make students of color feel more comfortable on two Green Bay area college campuses. Now, the Federal Reserve is weighing the possibility of issuing an official digital U.S. currency. The Reserve put out an analysis last week that talked about the potential benefits and the risks involved with creating a digital dollar as cryptocurrencies start to become more and more mainstream. The Biden administration is also working on possible changes in federal policy over online assets, including these cryptocurrencies. We're learning more about what exactly a digital dollar would be, how it would function, and where the world of cryptocurrency might go from here. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you confused about what cryptocurrencies are or how they work? I promise you, you are not alone. What questions do you have? Do you own any cryptocurrencies? Can you tell us what you bought, why you bought it? Would you feel more comfortable using these things if they were backed by the federal government? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Allison Versprill is a reporter for Bloomberg News who covers cryptocurrency and regulation. Allie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Can you talk about why the Federal Reserve is looking at getting into the cryptocurrency market?
Sure. So as they lay out in the report that they released last week, there are a lot of potential benefits to having a U.S. sort of digital dollar. One of those is that you would have potentially cheaper, faster payments. That would include if you're making payments, you know, from the U.S. to other countries. They've also said that, you know, having a digital dollar in the U.S. could help sort of maintain the dollar's dominance on the global scale. You know, we've seen other countries, specifically China, moving forward with their own digital currency. And so, you know, all of that goes into the process of trying to come up with this decision.
Let's talk about the basics here. What would a digital dollar be? What would that mean as opposed to, you know, I can pay online with my credit card or something like that?
So it's a good question. It's actually one that I have asked as well, because I, you know, getting into this, it was one of the main things I wanted to know. And the way it was explained to me by, you know, someone that works at a crypto firm was currently, if you're paying with, say, a credit card or some other online means of payment, there's typically a lag time. I know all of us have probably had those moments where we go and buy something and or you're transferring money to someone on a application like Venmo, and it takes a little while to show up in your bank account. The main difference that I've been told is that this would now be immediate. You would have much faster transactions. You could potentially avoid some of the costs associated with the ways you currently transact. And so those are all some of the potential benefits.
What did this paper say about the benefits and risks of the U.S. doing this, of creating this U.S. central bank digital currency?
So like I said, you know, the big one was cheaper, faster payments. They also talked a lot about the potential for more financial inclusion, bringing more folks who are currently unbanked into the financial system. And, you know, some of the ways that the Fed talked about that was maybe having using a central bank digital currency to collect taxes, or maybe even to deliver, you know, benefit payments directly to citizens. And then that could potentially happen, you know, at a quicker pace. Some of the risks, you know, the main ones are really that they're concerned about financial stability and, you know, the impacts that this would have on the current system. One of the points that they raised was that it could reduce the total amount of deposits in the banking system. It could result on, you know, runs on financial firms, you know, people taking their money out if they can more easily sort of convert other forms of money into these central bank digital currencies. They also raised, you know, consumer privacy and the need to balance, you know, folks' privacy with also the need to have some transparency into these transactions to be able to deter criminal activity, you know, think money laundering or terrorism finance.
Part of the story here is that a bunch of other countries are doing it. Where have we seen around the world other countries do their own version of a central bank digital currency?
You know, China is really the big one and the one that you hear talked most about in the U.S. And, you know, we're expecting that to sort of be featured at the Winter Olympics. So I guess stay tuned to see if that happens. You know, you're also seeing other countries look into this, and the U.S. has talked about this as being a potential, you know, move reason for them to move forward. You know, obviously they want to maintain the dominance that the U.S. dollar currently has. And I think the one thing is that we still don't have a sense of timing. If the Fed in this paper said this was really only a first step, they just want to start a discussion, and that they currently aren't taking a position one way or another if they're actually going to move forward.
We're talking to Allison Verspril, reporter for Bloomberg News, who covers cryptocurrency, looking at the idea of a U.S.-backed digital dollar, a U.S., an official version of, you know, the Bitcoins and the other things out there. Also, we're going to talk about calls for more regulation of the existing cryptocurrency market. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions, maybe your experiences if you've dabbled lightly or heavily in the world of these alternative currencies. 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Zach is with us in Madison. Zach, hi.
Hi there. Is this Rob?
This is Rob. Yeah, go for it, Zach. What did you want to say on the air?
Rob, I know every president since Joe Biden, all the way back to Nixon, we're basically living on a fiat currency. So it's all this cash is fake. There's nothing backed up by a gold standard. And someday, somehow, somewhere, we're all going to have to pay for it. And it's just crazy. It's like the United States government has a printing press, and they think they're just going to keep printing all this cash.
Zach, thanks for the call. Zach, talking about our existing money, but Allison, what would a digital currency be backed by, if anything, or is it by data mining like the Bitcoins? What would be the source of these digital dollars?
So, for the whole point of a central bank digital currency is that it would actually be backed by the Fed, and they tout this as a potential positive because right now we have, these other types of coins out there. We have stable coins, which private companies will issue, and they're supposed to be, pegged to the US dollar or other fiat currency so that you could exchange them out one for one for normal currency. But there's been concern raised by lawmakers that these companies aren't keeping enough in reserve. And so, the government has said that if they were to move forward with a central bank digital currency, that, or digital dollar, if you will, that would help some of those address some of those potential concerns.
Thanks for that call, Zach, at 800-642-1234. While this is going on, Allie, you've also been covering calls from some in Congress, maybe some talks within the Biden administration about how we regulate these existing current cryptocurrencies. There are lots of them. I think Bitcoin is the most famous. What kind of talk is there out there now?
So there's a lot of talk, a lot of different industry or different agencies that are trying to, figure out how to regulate the space. Currently, the White House, and we reported this at the end of last week, but the White House is working on an executive order that would essentially, provide some guidance to agencies, direct them to write reports on, different either benefits or risks, including the potential risk for illicit finance or the effects that these digital assets have on financial stability. So we're going to see potentially some direction from the White House on that. Elsewhere, we're seeing a lot of action. Currently, the Treasury Department is working on some rules that would require, companies that sort of facilitate cryptocurrency transactions to report user data to the IRS. That was passed in a law last year in the big infrastructure package. And essentially what the government has said is that that would allow them to get some transparency into these transactions to, make sure that people are actually paying the taxes that they owe. So that's something that's also on the horizon that we're keeping an eye on.
These are volatile products, a lot of these cryptocurrencies, and we just saw over the last week big drops in their value. Is part of the story here that there is talk of maybe more regulation of people not being able to do the things with these coins that they might have expected to be able to do?
I will say volatility is one of the things that gets brought up most by lawmakers and the government. They worry about how that affects the financial system. And like you said, we have seen some pretty big drops in the market over the last several days. It's about 50% from a record high in November. So that's been discussed a lot in this Federal Reserve report, and also in past analyses by the government, you know, how do you address that? How do you make sure that consumers are protected? So a lot of that is being talked about as they work on regulations or as Congress works on legislation on the Hill.
We're talking with Bloomberg News reporter Ali Verspril about the prospects for a U.S. digital dollar, a digital currency like Bitcoin, but backed by the U.S. government. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like the idea of a digital dollar? Do you not fully understand it? Again, if so, you are not alone. Join in at 800-642-1234. And in the existing world of cryptocurrencies, have you personally taken the plunge and bought some of these things? Use them to buy things? Which ones? What led you into it? Do you like the idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Ali Verspril. She's a reporter for Bloomberg News with us today talking about cryptocurrency and the potential for a digital U.S. dollar, the Federal Reserve looking at that idea. Not a done deal yet. No timeline to get it at this point. You could join in, though, at 800-642-1234. Do you feel secure making digital transactions now? Do you want more regulation or protections in federal policy? Would you feel more secure buying and selling digital dollars compared to the current system, the different products, the bitcoins and whatnot on the market? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go back to your calls now with Mike in Rusk County. Mike, hi.
Hi. I hate the idea. I never did see the point. And I'm digitally literate. work in the IT space. I'm not some old fuddy-duddy out here, but I will tell you, when it comes to this particular idea, I am an old fuddy-duddy. We have a well-seasoned financial system that's based on a certain idea, and to go in there and completely do a upheaval and replace it all for what I consider to be a gimmick, that we don't know all the where's and what for's of it. I think it's awfully dangerous place to go or even consider. And I haven't seen a good, I missed the earlier part of the show, but I have not seen a good case for what our benefits are going to be. Everything you could do with digital money, you can do with virtual dollars.
Mike, thanks a lot for the call. Ali, that's part of why the Federal Reserve isn't going full speed ahead on it. There are concerns that people share with Mike.
Yes, and I think, you know, there are folks that are sharing concerns. The government has talked about some of its potential concerns. It's one of the reasons that they have said that this is really just a first step. They want to examine all of the risks and benefits. They've opened this comment period up to the public where people can actually submit their comments, provide their thoughts on risk or benefits. And those are all due by May 20th. And I will say, you know, we're expecting to see a lot more research on this as well. I know the Boston Fed is actually working on a report about the technology that could run a digital dollar. And so we're expecting that as soon as next month. You know, I think the Fed has laid it out. They think there are some potential benefits. They think there are some potential risks, and they really just haven't come to a decision yet. And so they're still evaluating all of that.
Mike, thanks for the call. And Mike used the word replace, Ali. And I think it's clear there's not talk of getting rid of our current dollars and cents to replace them with America coin or whatever it ends up being called. This would be in addition to. Do I have that right?
Yes. So the Fed in their report has stressed that this is not a replacement to the, you know, the current paper currency that we have. They want these things to work in tandem. They want them to work even with some of the products that are being offered by the private sector. So they're hoping that these things can sort of live in harmony, not replace each other.
Thanks again for that call. We'll go next to Rusty in Wauwatosa. Rusty, hi.
Yeah, I just wanted to make a comment. You know, I've worked in the securities area, and
here's the problem. It's not backed by anything. It's like saying, it's like, you know, Rob saying, hey, I'm going to sell some Rob coins. You know, you've got PayPal and everything, but it's backed up by money that's somewhere in a bank or an account. But, you know, I think if we go down this road, more and more companies are going to start promoting, you know, all kinds of coin, electronic coin, but it's not backed by anything. It's just fictitious. And, yeah, some people have made millions of dollars, but a lot of people have lost millions of dollars, too. It's way too dangerous. You know, if the government backs it, you know, somehow with real backing, I don't see a problem with that. But I just think there's too much danger here to go down this route.
Rusty, thanks a lot for the call. I think there is a Rob coin on the market, so they're out ahead of me. I can't start my own Rob coin. Also, Ferret coin is taken. But Ellie, this is a concern a lot of people have that, I don't know, these digital currencies are maybe a consensual hallucination. I don't know. What do you think of what Rusty had to say?
So I'll stress that there are, you know, differences between what, you know, between what's out there currently. So there are normal cryptocurrencies as you kind of think of them. You know, Bitcoin, you have Ether. There are also these stable coins, which are also issued by private companies. And as I mentioned before, those are supposed to be pegged to the US dollar or another fiat currency that's supposed to keep them more stable. Like I said, there has been talk of regulating those stablecoin issuers so that they have to be more like banks and, you know, have to show that they have enough in reserves to actually back these stable coins. So that's something that's being talked about a lot right now on both the Hill and both in Congress, and that, or sorry, both the Hill and both, you know, within the executive branch. And then, you know, we have these potential central bank digital currencies, which would be backed by the Federal Reserve. And so there are a couple different things that are happening right now, and I don't want them to get confused. And that's all being discussed. You know, Congress and the White House are trying to do their best to, you know, figure out the path forward here.
Thanks again for that call, Rusty. We're talking to Ali Verspril from Bloomberg News. She writes about cryptocurrency. We're talking about the idea of a U.S.-backed digital coin and other related issues to regulation and more. We'll go back to your calls now. Audi is with us in Green Bay. Audi, hi.
Hi. I'd just like to say that, you know, of course they want to take away Bitcoin from the people because it's something they don't have control over. And they've managed to put us into outrageous debt and outrageous inflation due to the incompetence of politicians and various others. I mine Bitcoin and I love it. And it's just, it's great and it's revolutionary. And you can't be putting your thumb down on this technology just because you're afraid of volatility. Volatility will subside once it becomes more mainstream, and they're just afraid of it because they want to take it and blow it up and take the power away from the retail investor. All right, I'm going.
Thanks a lot for sharing that, Ali. This Audi clearly a core customer for alternative currencies and very skeptical, it sounds like, of the idea of working with a U.S.-backed cryptocurrency. It would defeat the point. Is that, I don't know, is that going to make it hard to sell to the community that currently uses this stuff?
You know, that's not something that we've really addressed yet in our reporting. But, you know, there are definitely proponents of the traditional cryptocurrencies. And, you know, they believe and have talked about the benefits that they see from those. And then there are also these proponents of the central bank digital currencies. And I've seen some overlap, you know, of analysts that are talking about both. And again, you know, like we talked about earlier, I think the idea is that they're hoping that these are, you know, two kind of separate things that may be able to exist with each other. And that's what the Federal Reserve has talked about. It's talked about not having the central bank digital currency, you know, being a replacement for paper currency. And, you know, in the past, Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Federal Reserve, has talked about other types of digital assets like stablecoins being able to exist alongside a central bank digital currency. So I think the thought here is that they're trying to determine how they can continue to promote innovation while still regulating this space, and then, you know, continuing to see what the government can actually do on its end to ensure that it remains you know, a dominant player in the financial system, global financial system.
And Audi also mentioned hopes that things like Bitcoin would become more mainstream. And I definitely wanted to ask you about that, Ali. This used to be, you know, some high tech people, maybe a certain criminal market, people skeptical of governments. It seems less fringe now, and it's getting more mainstream. How much is it, though?
You know, we've definitely seen it becoming a bit more mainstream. We've seen more people joining and investing, and you see that with the prices going up. And it's also a reason, you know, the government has talked about this, and it's a reason why they're now trying to sort of get ahead of it. You know, if they feel like digital currency is here to stay, then they want to be able to get a handle on it and they want to be able to regulate it. And so that's why you now see, you know, the White House stepping in and wanting to take a central role as well. So it's definitely something that's catching people's attention. It's no longer sort of sitting on the fringes and the government's just going to let it slide. So they're looking at ways to regulate it.
In just our last few moments, Ali, it's clear from our conversation, you've got a busy beat to cover. What are you watching for next in the world of cryptocurrencies?
So, you know, we're watching a lot of things. We're trying to see if Congress is going to pass legislation. You know, they had Democrats even on their own had difficulties passing this big social spending bill that they were looking at the end of last year. So I think the big question remains to be seen is, can Democrats and Republicans agree on legislation this year? We know there's been some interest from both sides on stable coins, for instance. Like I said, that's been a really top focus because a lot of them would like issuers to be regulated more like banks. So we're keeping an eye on that. I'm keeping an eye on, you know, any regulation we see coming out of these agencies, in particular, the rules that are going to be coming from the Treasury Department on the reporting requirements for certain types of brokers. And I think, too, you know, I mentioned that the Federal Reserve didn't offer any sort of timing on a central bank digital currency. But I will note that Bank of America strategists today in a research note said that they think a U.S. digital dollar is inevitable, and they were predicting issuance happening sometime between 2025 and 2030. So
a lot to watch for. Thanks to our guest, Ali Verspril from Bloomberg News, looking at cryptocurrency and the idea of a U.S. digital coin. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, get some advice on care and maintenance of your teeth from a dentist. That's tomorrow on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we find out why a proposed sandhill crane hunting season in Wisconsin could threaten the extremely rare whooping crane. Now, when Chris Kimbrell left his home in Arkansas to come to Wisconsin, he knew he'd be leaving behind some much milder winters. What he brought with him, though, was a passion for cutting hair and building community through the barbershop business. He's the owner of Stars Barber and Beauty of Green Bay. In just over a week, he'll be overseeing the grand opening of a new location on the campus of UW-Green Bay. They've already been cutting students' hair weekly at St. Norbert College, the goal to make students of color more comfortable in their college career. Chris Kimbrough is with us now to talk about these new projects. Chris, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. How are you doing today?
Well, good. Why did you want to start making sure your haircuts were available on those two campuses?
You know, we just wanted to make sure that, you know, people of color felt at home while they were here. You know, we had a lot of people, a lot of students that were coming in town and, you know, already visiting my other locations that I have. And they were just, you know, voicing some concerns about, you know, coming in town to Green Bay area where they just felt like, you know, it didn't feel like home, or they was like, oh, I miss home and I miss, you know, being able to get haircuts like I want all the time and all that. So, you know, we kind of partnered with the university to try to make things better for them and just kind of make them feel at home more, so we didn't have to worry about them transferring to other communities and things of that nature. Really just also back in Wisconsin, you know, the snowstorms and things like that happen. It's just safer for them to be on campus than to be traveling all around the community trying to get haircuts. And if I can make that an easier way for them or a better life while they're here in town, I that's what I want to do.
Now let's start with the haircuts in particular. You had guys on campus saying, I think they were going to wait till, you know, winter break or summer break or whatever to get a haircut because they didn't have local barbers that could meet their needs.
Right. They will go to, they will, you know, a lot of students, they'll wait till you get back home or you know, and on some type of break, summer break, winter break or whatever, to get haircuts. And I'm like, no, you know, we can try to make things better because I do have a couple other locations as well, and they stay booked up all the time. So, you know, we just saw opportunity to be able to come together and make things better for them. And, you know, we jumped on the opportunity.
When you're a barber, you get a chance to talk to your clients. What kind of concerns, what kind of worries do they talk about in their college careers?
You know, a lot of guys just, again, they talk about being here, a new area. You know, it's always, change is always difficult at times. And so, you know, some of the guys that come from different towns, maybe in Illinois, Missouri, or wherever, you know, it's just, and coming here to Wisconsin, where it's always cold and you know, it's always snowy, seem like, things of that nature, just they kind of get a little depressed sometimes. And so being a barber and knowing the history of barbering, we were usually your town's big brothers, your town psychologists. Like, we were the counselors, because, you know, like I know, everybody knows, you know, what goes on in the barbershop. Everybody talks to the barber. We know everything that goes on in the community. So, you know, being able to have that outlet for them to come talk to and kind of help them, encourage them on a day-to-day basis, somebody they can actually have there as a big brother or even a big sister, that means a lot to them.
Is there a concern that they feel like they really stand out? I was just looking at the numbers for both campuses, mostly white, fairly few black people by percentage. Is it just nice for them to have a community where they don't stand out for the length of a haircut?
Exactly. It's very important for them. You know, it's very important for them to feel welcome. And one thing about the business that I brought here is where I come from, you see a lot of Caucasian, they stick with Caucasian shops. A lot of the, you know, the black people, they stick with a lot of the black shops. Well, I wanted to make sure I bring something together where we all could come together as one. And with Black History Month coming up, I always think about Dr. Martin Luther King. One of the things he said is, you know, for us to come together. He had a dream that we all would be together, you know, and sometimes looking out at the shop and seeing every different race and every different culture all together in one place, having a good time and talking about sports or talking about things that are going on in the world. It's a beautiful thing. It is. It's a really beautiful thing, and having the students being able to witness that is even more beautiful.
Now, you're running a business, of course, but it sounds like it's super important for you, Chris, to help build community. Why is that important to you?
Well, me personally, my mom, I come from a single parent home. My mom, may she rest in peace, she passed recently last year in January, and she was a teacher. She was she worked in the educational field. So I kind of grew up with a hospitable heart. Come from my mother, my upbringing. So it's just me being an ex-police officer as well. I work with communities, and I see the things in the community that community needs. And me being here and coming from law enforcement, I still had that community heart in me, you know. And so I just came here, and I saw the things that need to be done, and I'm a real go-getter. I'm real proactive. I don't like to be a reactive person. I like to prevent things if we can keep it from happening. When the George Floyd thing went down a couple years ago, I had an event in front of my shop. Let's talk. Let's come together. Let's talk. Let's try to prevent what happened to other communities from happening here. And that's what we did. And that's what I'm all about.
Now, Chris, you've been working on St. Norbert's campus. You're headed to UW-Green Bay now. What are your hopes? What do you hope comes out of all this effort?
You know, just togetherness, unity. I just love it. I just love being that person that they can come to when they have questions or even concerns in the area. I just love doing it. And that's what matters to me, is that the kids feel at home. They feel more safe, more comfortable being here away from home. And a parent from St. Norbert, example, his mom is from Alaska, I believe, and he got a haircut. And his mother hit me up on social media and, you know, was just expressing how much she appreciated us being there for him, how much he appreciated him getting his hair cut, because he wasn't getting his hair cut, you know, on a normal basis like he should have or even was accustomed to where he was from. And she just, you know, she appreciated it. And to me, that done my heart well. If I know I can be a help for someone, that's what I try to do.
Chris, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
That's Chris Kimbrough, owner of Stars Barber and Beauty of Green Bay. We talked to him about opening up on-campus haircut spots at St. Norbert College and coming up UW-Green Bay to help students of color in the Green Bay area feel more at home. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Brad Kohlberg with a story about finding a place to watch the Green Bay Packers in New York City.
It's pretty well established that Packer fans travel well. Just scan the crowd at any opponent's stadium and you'll see plenty of green and gold. But when writer and Wisconsin native Sandy Reitman just wanted to watch a game on TV with some other cheeseheads while living in New York City, she went looking for a Packer bar.
Born and raised in Milwaukee, I've been a Green Bay Packers fan since I was born. I'll admit that there were a couple of years when I had a crush on the San Francisco 49ers starting line back in the 90s, but my love for the Packers has always been there. It helps that each of my parents have a set of gold package season tickets, and I could get to a game even back when I was living in New York City. When I moved to the Big Apple, my friends there weren't exactly football fans. I was already a regular at Kettle of Fish, a Wisconsin bar on the west side of Manhattan, where I knew I could get a slice of the Dairy State any day of the week. But getting into Kettle of Fish for Packer games required waiting in line, and it was a whole big to-do. Not really my thing. I'm a big Packer fan, but not really a huge football fan, if that's a thing. Yes, the Bears still suck. Then, one day, I ran into one of my oldest friends from kindergarten, and he gave me the scoop on another Packer bar in the city, Tom and Jerry's, on the east side of Manhattan, which was my part of town. Tom and Jerry's was everything I wanted in a Packer bar, and nothing more. Now, how did it become a Packer bar? Well, it was historically known as a bar for members of the media, but when the owners put football games on their TVs, they realized they absolutely loved Packer fans. They were nice, passionate, big drinkers who were super loyal to their team. So the owners decided to make it an unofficial Packer bar, complete with taxidermy and kitschy Wisconsin-esque decor. They had great beer, a full bar, and old-school Tom and Jerry bowls, just like the name of the place suggested. And the Packers faithful loved it.
Give it up, Packer fans!
Sundays were the biggest draw for Packer fans at Tom and Jerry's. But no matter when Green Bay was playing, it was the perfect place to get a taste of home. The free brats with all the toppings served at halftime during every game was a nice touch and a total hit. It was also an unexpected but welcome place for reunions. I would run into friends from back home that I'd otherwise never see in the city. It was impossible not to find a friend to watch the game with inside Tom and Jerry's. It was electric. People who weren't Packer fans would become Packer fans, cheering right alongside me and the other Wisconsin expats. Tom and Jerry's was an authentic, sometimes sports bar, that created a little bit of Wisconsin in the great big city of New York. Whether you were there for the game, the food, the drink, or the company, you could get a taste of home, even for a few hours, when the Packers were playing.
Sandy Reitman is a writer and a Packer fan, now living in Milwaukee. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Brad Kohlberg.
Coming up, environmental advocates and ornithologists are concerned that a proposed sandhill crane hunting season in Wisconsin would further endanger the extremely rare whooping crane. A crane expert joins the show. That's next here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Last month, four whooping cranes were shot and killed in Oklahoma. Whooping cranes are extremely rare, with a global population of less than 1,000 birds. The killing of whooping cranes in Oklahoma has revived fears that a proposed sandhill crane hunting season here in Wisconsin would put whooping cranes in danger, as hunters sometimes confuse the two species. The state Senate approved a bill last fall that would allow a sandhill season here in the state. Rich Belfus is president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
Well, what do we know about the shooting of these four whooping cranes down in Oklahoma?
Well, we don't know who did it yet. That's still under investigation. I don't know if they have anybody suspected or not, but we do know that it was during a sandhill crane hunting season in Oklahoma. So it is kind of our worst fear when these birds are shot by mistaken ID during some other hunting season. Yeah.
And let's talk about whooping cranes. Very rare. Talk a little bit about this long-term effort to slowly bring their numbers back up.
Yeah, whooping cranes certainly been a long recovery. You know, they managed to survive that period, you know, 150 years ago or so when we lost our passenger pigeons and others, but their numbers got very low, fewer than 20 in the wild. And they've had a long, slow recovery. They winter in Texas and breed way north in Canada. And then starting back in about 2000, we started working to bring back a population here in the eastern U.S., that includes the whoopers here in Wisconsin that we've been reintroducing now for about 21 years. And those whooping cranes in Wisconsin that migrate a little bit in the south to the southeast, they are still very rare in our state. There's about 80 in the wild right here in Wisconsin. We've been slowly trying to bring them back and get them as a breeding population here in our state. So, yeah.
And then sandhill cranes, Rich, can you talk about they weren't ever as threatened as whooping cranes. Their numbers were down, but they're substantially up again in Wisconsin.
Yeah, that's right. Sandhill cranes are really a fantastic conservation story here. Their numbers were down, certainly in Wisconsin. There was a time when we thought we might lose them, but they've had a wonderful recovery now for about 70 years. We have good numbers in the state, probably 15,000 or so breeding pair of Wisconsin, of sandhill cranes across Wisconsin. And it's a wonderful success story. They've been spreading into the eastern part of the country as well and breeding in lots of neighboring states where they hadn't been seen in more than 100 years. So it's been fun. And, you know, people call and write us all the time to talk about their experience seeing them in local parks and out in farm fields and, you know, sort of wherever they are around the state. So that's been really fun for people.
As we mentioned, Oklahoma is one state that has a sandhill crane hunting season. Proposals in the state legislature to do that here in Wisconsin. What are your thoughts on the idea of a sandhill crane season in the state?
Yeah, well, we have a lot of concerns here in Wisconsin. They are hunted in the southeast in several states on migration, and they are hunted out west where there's a bigger population. But there isn't a hunt yet on their breeding grounds. And we have a lot of concerns about that up here. They are growing in numbers, but still very sensitive. It takes years for them to pair up and have their first chick. And then they only have one or maybe two chicks a year. So they can be very sensitive to a hunt very quickly. And then as they occur in the state here, we have, as we said, concerns about being misidentified with whooping cranes and other issues. So we are worried about how a hunt would go here, even though they are hunted in other states where they move through on migration.
Talking to Rich Belfus, president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation, that's based here in Wisconsin, looking at the shooting of four whooping cranes, a very rare bird species right now down in Oklahoma, the idea of a sandhill crane hunting season here in the state. Rich, one concern, you know, is that some farmers are worried that we have enough sandhill cranes that they're interfering with their crops, eating seeds before they can germinate. Is that a problem? Do you see a hunt as being a solution to that problem, if so?
It absolutely is a problem, and we are very committed to working with farmers in the state to solve the problem. We have been working on it since for almost 20 years as well. We've worked with a company called Archaean to develop a bad-tasting chemical. It's not toxic, but you apply it to seed, and the cranes don't eat the seed when it first germinates. So we have a solution, and the problem is that we need to get it as affordable as possible to farmers. It's not very expensive, but it's one more cost for farmers, and we recognize that. And we need to make it more convenient for farmers so they don't have to apply it in the hopper, but we want it to actually get treated at the source on seeds sold in the state of Wisconsin. So we think we have good solutions, and we know that a hunting season is not going to solve crop depredation for farmers. It may trigger some payments that won't last long, but it is not a solution. So we really feel we can bear down and solve the problem in Wisconsin and in surrounding states as well rather than through a hunting season.
I know your philosophy at the Crane Foundation is to work with locals to solve those kinds of problems, whether we're talking about Wisconsin or East Asia or in Africa. Can you talk about the idea of trying to work with communities to help preserve cranes around the world?
Absolutely. Yeah, the communities everywhere that cranes occur in the wild, they're in and around people. They're in communities and close to people. And so community-based conservation, as we call it, is a really big part of what we do. And communities have great views on how to solve these problems. They often need resources and access and other things, trainings and all, to kind of do these solutions. But we get lots of great ideas to solve things. And I think the same is true here. And when we're dealing with crop depredations, farmers see the birds on their fields. They know the times of year when it's a problem and the times of year when it's not. And we need to work on those sensitive periods when crops are still germinating to find solutions for on the farm use. But we're very committed everywhere, whether they're common cranes like our sandhill cranes or some of our more endangered birds like the whoopers. Everywhere that cranes are, we are working with local communities to try to come up with good strategies to protect them and keep them going.
As you mentioned, whooping cranes, it's been this decades-plus effort to bring them back, especially that eastern population. What is 2022 looking like?
Well, we hope 2022 is getting us further out of this period of the pandemic. The last couple of years have been difficult because a lot of zoos that help provide breeding programs, too, to get birds back in the wild were at lower capacity. They didn't have visitors and so on. But we're really gearing back up for now in the next couple of years, hoping to get, one is to get more birds back in the wild that can migrate, and then also to continue to support the birds that are out there so that they can successfully breed and have chicks. We have a number of problems to solve still, but each year we're sort of getting further and further along. Unfortunately, shootings, along with a couple other threats, especially power line collisions, are the biggest cause of loss of the birds that we're putting back in the wild. So it's a big concern for us.
What kind of efforts are there to prevent those shootings and the power line collisions?
Yeah, on the shootings, we have extension staff down in Alabama and Indiana and Louisiana, also up here in Wisconsin, just working on trying to support hunter education programs. We have pamphlets that get out that show the differences and how to ID the different birds. And we work with communities trying to create, sort of watchdog communities of caring around areas where whooping cranes are showing up, whether they might be wintering and so on. So, and we work, for example, with friends groups around national wildlife refuges and other places trying to support these birds. There's so much passion and excitement about them showing up in different states. In the South, I was just at a big festival in Alabama where they're really celebrating having a dozen whooping cranes down there for the winter. And then on the power lines, we try to work for good sighting. We try to avoid really sensitive areas where the birds are roosting or breeding, and then where you can mark power lines to make them more visible. So there's a number of strategies. Biggest one is keeping power lines out of really sensitive crane areas can go a long way.
Rich, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much. Great to be with you.
That's Rich Belfast, president and CEO of the International Crane Foundation. He talked to us about a proposal to have a sandhill crane hunting season here in Wisconsin and concerns about how that could affect endangered whooping cranes in the state along one of their breeding areas. You could share your thoughts, maybe your sightings of sandhills, or if you're really lucky, whooping cranes. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, confidence is the key to success, and there are ways to build it up. That's the message from the author of the new book, The Confident Mind. We'll check in on the latest on Russia, Ukraine, NATO, and the U.S. as developments keep going on, negotiations keep stalling. And internal research from social media companies shows the negative impact that platforms can have on teen girls. Our guest has been raising that concern for years. We'll find out why and how the newest findings have backed up her worries. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.